Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the business of any transaction that may legally come before it.
Good morning. This is the time and the place that has been noticed for the annual rules hearing of the South Dakota Supreme Court. Notice was duly given through our appropriate outlets, such as the State Bar Newsletter, and we have several proposals in front of us this morning to review. There have been a couple of written responses, one by the South Dakota Defense Lawyers Association, another by the firm of Davenport, Evans, Hurwitz, and Smith on Proposal 5. It is not necessary, if those folks are here today, to get up and read it to us. We've already read it. But obviously, if anybody has anything to say on any of the rules, we'll certainly listen to what you have. We'll simply proceed down the list the way they were sent out in the notice. The first one, number one, is a proposed amendment to SDCL 15650B. Are there any proponents for this measure that wish to speak? Mr. Barnett.
Morning, Chief Justice, Justices. The only thing, the rule speaks for itself. I just want to advise the court that at the time that this was submitted, because of the notice requirements, the Bar Commissioners had not yet had an opportunity to vote on that particular proposal, and that's why Ms. Marceau submitted it in her own name as chair of the Practice Rules Committee. I can tell you that the Bar Commissioners unanimously support this rule. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barnett. Any other proponents for rule proposal number one? If not, any opponents? Excuse me. If not, we'll proceed to proposal number two. And this would amend SDCL 1526A6. Are there any proponents? There being none, are there any opponents? There being none, we'll go to proposal number three. This would amend SDCL 1539-55. Ms. Roberts, representing the administrative staff of the Supreme Court.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. It's an honor to make my first appearance before you this morning. I just wanted to give a little background about this. It comes to the State Court Administrator's Office through the request of the presiding judges to streamline the process of small claims and to allow the disposition of cases that are sitting there for a lengthy period of time. And I'll be willing to answer any questions if you have any.
There being none, you get by easy on your first trip up here. Any other proponents? If not, any opponents to proposal number three? There being none, we'll proceed to number four, which would propose to amend SDCL 16227.1. Ms. Roberts.
And again, Chief Justice, Justices, as you know, currently it's mandatory for clerks of courts to assist with the application of passports, and this amendment would simply make it permissive and allow the circuits to decide for themselves whether or not they want their clerks of courts to continue with this. The reason for this amendment is because some of our offices are now unable to comply with the new procedural changes and requirements that the U.S. Passport Agency is due to 9/11. There's continual changes and further training and testing and requirements now. And some of our offices are simply overworked and do not have time to complete all these new requirements. And they would like to opt out of performing and handling passports.
I assume also that some of our more rural offices that are open in limited hours, where we may have a person there a half day or a day a week, probably wouldn't fit the category of people appropriately trained either.
Yes, Chief Justice, that is correct. Actually, it's quite burdensome. They have to take classes online now. They have to take tests. They have to comply with all sorts of new requirements, and it's simply impossible. And plus, as you mentioned, they're part-time only. We do have some rural clerks of courts that do want to continue, but there are some that are just simply overwhelmed by all the new requirements.
Okay. Any,
can those people go to additional other counties, any other counties, to obtain passports?
Chief Justice, Justice Sabres, yes, they have the post office in many places that they can go to, and currently South Dakota statute allows them to, the Register of Deeds, to also handle this. And more Register of Deeds are wanting to and applying to do this as well. So there are different options that people can go to get the passport applications.
Thank you.
Any further questions from Ms. Roberts? Not, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other proponents for number four? If not, are there any opponents? All right, then we'll go to five. This would propose a new rule designated as SDCL 1916-8.3. I believe this was before us in a different format last year, and although we don't have anything in writing, this was submitted by Mr. Nacer, wasn't it, Clerk? All right. Any proponents for proposal number five? Mr. McCarron.
Chief Justice Gilbertson, Justices of this Honorable Court, Kit McCarron. Actually, Mr. Nacer asked me to appear today. This proposal would help expedite both plaintiff's attorneys, defense counsel, and the court to determine in those unique cases where there are any genuine substantive issues involving the medical expenses. In most cases, at least in the state of South Dakota, generally stipulated, you're able to, you know, work out with defense counsel, look, well, we're willing to stipulate that these are fair, reasonable, and the necessary medical expenses. However, on occasion, unique situations arise where this would allow plaintiffs of that counsel the opportunity to offer by affidavit what the medical expenses are, and then the defense counsel can then, by a similar response, show what they feel, you know, is related and is not related, and then the court can then make the ultimate determination on it. But it would help both parties, including the court, and promote judicial economy. And the court has already taken some comment on this sometime before, and I believe at that point one of the problems was that there was only a 30-day time window, and this change allows a 60-day time window. Yeah.
How would this help the defense?
The defense? The occasionally you have a defense attorney who's being encouraged or forced to promote some sort of a spite defense by their insurance carrier or by their client. And this, in this situation where they would then, if there's an actual pleading with an affidavit, they'd then actually be having to take a legal position instead of just deny as being pressed into it by their carrier or by their client.
Can you think of any other examples?
As to how it would help the defense counsel?
Right. Or maybe a fairer question to you would be, have you had an opportunity to read the response by Davenport Evans and the response by the Defense Lawyers Association?
Yes.
Okay. What would you have to say in response to their letters?
I have the one from Mr. Evans here. Would you, any particular order? Is that the one from talking about?
There's one from Craig Kennedy, and there's one from.
You mean Craig Feifley, Justice Sabres?
Pardon?
Craig Feifley, you
no,
mean?
No, from Kennedy, and I can give you mine if you have not seen it. And then there's one signed by about a dozen or so lawyers from Davenport Evans.
Perhaps what we could do, just a suggestion, is allow Mr. McCarron to read these letters, proceed to the next people that want to speak, and then invite Mr. McCarron back. Is that all right with you, Justice Sabres?
Yes. Do you have the one from Davenport Evans?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, we'll bring you back. How about that? And we'll give you an opportunity to read that. Mr. Tellinghuis.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Roger Tellinghuis on behalf of the South Dakota Trial Lawyers. I just very quickly want to say that last year when this rule was presented to the court for the first time and taken under consideration, we offered our support for this rule. We continue to offer our support for this rule, and we believe that the time frames that have now been adjusted to provide for a greater period of time from the time of filing the initial affidavit and then the time frame within which to file an objecting affidavit are appropriate, and we would encourage the adoption of the rule. In anticipation of Justice Sabers's question of me, I have not read the letters from the two opponents, and I will do so as Mr. McCarron comes back up and attempts to respond to your question.
Weren't you told there was going to be a test?
I should have anticipated that. I'm sorry.
Would the clerk give Mr. telling he was in the Davenport letter, please? Okay. All right. All right. Any other proponents while these gentlemen are reading? If not, we will go to the opponents. Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chief Justice and Justices, John Brown appearing for the South Dakota Defense Lawyers Association. And as Chief Justice pointed out, you have received a letter from our association president, I am not going to read the letter. I think it clearly sets out the position of our association. There is, in terms of the drafting of the proposed amendment, a question that I have, and perhaps I'm not following it as closely as I should, but it appears that the proposal calls for an affidavit to be submitted not later than the earlier of 60 days before the evidence first presented or the final deadline set by trial court for the filing of pretrial motions, and then provides for a time frame or the counter affidavit 30 days after receiving a copy of the affidavit. And then my real question is on subsection B there, at least 14 days before the day on which evidence first presented at the trial of the case. It doesn't appear to me that that would have any application if you have the earlier of 60 days or a motion deadline set by the court. I don't see how that second provision even comes into effect. Not that that is a major issue, I guess, in terms of our opposition to the rule, but I think it is a drafting issue that probably would need to be addressed in any event. The association just feels that this being an amendment to the evidentiary rules as pointed out in the letter, that stipulation or request for admissions would work as effectively as this, and that there's no need for this particular amendment.
Questions for Mr. Brown? No, thank you.
I'd also point out, in terms of the letter from our association, I don't know how those, I don't suppose those letters were submitted to the persons testifying in front of us by our association, so I don't know that they would have had opportunity to see those letters previously.
I think generally the rule requires them to be filed with the court, which they were. Thank you, Mr. Brown. Any other opponents of proposal number 5? Being none, Mr. McCarron, have you had time to read the letter? Wish to respond further?
Yes, I do, Chief Justice, Justices of this Honorable Court. Basically, how this allows to assist defense counsel also is that this is no different than, for instance, putting out a motion for summary judgment. If the plaintiff's attorney is offering medical expenses and the defense counsel is not prepared to stipulate to the same, it just says you must have a reason that you're not willing to do that. If it's just spite, then you have no reason. If you have a reason to contest the reasonable necessary medical expenses, set it forth, because you must have some basis for it. So good faith defenses are not affected. It's just bad faith defenses or difficulty or just for whatever reason, but good faith defenses are still preserved.
Why do we need a new rule on this? Why won't the current rules, summary judgment, interrogatories, things like that, suffice?
Um, Well, I guess actually I think you would have left out the one that I would normally would have been used, which would be request for admissions. But that's...
Yeah, why wouldn't that work?
Well, that's sort of unyield...
Either deny this is fair and reasonable in this amount.
Correct. Okay. So then what you do is, from a plaintiff standpoint, you send out interrogatories, request for admissions, request for production, and you get something back with 1,000 different objections and no answers. Then you do a motion to, a motion to deem admitted for lack of substantive denial. Then you come back before the court. You get there the same way, although with now your file has gone to about this thick with getting the denials back from whatever defense firm. So this eliminates that instead of just getting unqualified denials and taking up more court time and counsel's time. You set forth the affidavit. If you have a good faith defense, write down what it is.
But Mr. McCarron, if the objection's in bad faith, you have a remedy under the existing rules. If they in bad faith deny the reasonableness of the claim, if they file answers to admissions, objections to admissions, or answers to interrogatories that are in bad faith, you have a remedy for that.
I've never seen it, Justice Zinner, I've never seen it work for me really very well, or certainly very swiftly.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Okay. Further questions for Mr. McCarron?
I have one other one. One of the objections raised by the defense lawyers is that this rule would eliminate a defendant who wants to simply utilize cross-examination to challenge the necessity of the reasonableness or necessity of the expenses. In other words, the doctor's on the stand, and the defendant just wants to cross them on it and challenge it that way. It would seem to me that they may have a point that this would eliminate that right. Challenge evidence solely by cross-examination.
I have to look back through the rule, but I think the rule would still allow you. The rule is not intended to preclude any good faith defense. And I would agree with you, Justice Zinner, that you would still have the right to cross-examination of all witnesses. But I think even with the affidavit, you can set forth what your good faith defense would be. But
the rule requires that the defendant come forward with an expert to justify the position, and
well,
currently that you wouldn't have to do that if you wanted to challenge the evidence by cross-examination alone.
Does the rule require an expert or just a person competent to testify?
Well, I don't, either one, it doesn't matter, I guess. It says,
then, Your Honor, Justice Zinner, you can file your affidavit, and that can still be ruled on by the trial bench. The trial bench isn't going to certainly interfere with the cross-examination of any live witnesses. However, it's very rare that you get into a trial where you've got a treating physician testifying live. You may have experts testifying live as to causation, but very seldom are you ever, most of your treating physicians are deposed days to weeks to months in advance of trial, and their deposition transcripts are readily available. So in those instances, Justice Zinner, that aspect of the case is already tried.
Any further questions for Mr. McCarron?
I guess the language says by a person who's qualified by knowledge, skill, experience, training, education, or other expertise to testify in contravention of reasonableness and necessity.
So that would Justice Zinner wouldn't require it to be, even, you know, be a doctor. I mean, even just somebody from their staff or somebody who's reviewing the records or reviewing the bills. If they have some particular objection to it, they can set forth what it is, and it remains in dispute.
The only other question, and I don't care if it's you or Mr. Tellingson, but the only other question I had was the question or the third objection of Davenport's firm. They question whether the rule means that the service was necessary as a result of the injury sustained. You know, you oftentimes have clients with multiple prior unrelated injuries, and so you have an issue about whether these medical services, you know, are related to the injury sustained.
Correct.
And they say the rule doesn't indicate whether, it's not clear whether that means as a result of the injury sustained, or at least doesn't sort that out. What's your response to that? The rule seems to imply to me that it would be, it suggests that it's as a result of the injury sustained.
And there again, Justice Zinner, if you feel that your answer is that it was unrelated, you can just simply set that forth, and at least you have the both sides setting forth their positions, and you know what it is, instead of Justice Meyer having inquired with a follow-up from you of interrogatories, request for production, motion for summary judgment. You're never sure what's what, and I'll take up all this court time trying to get somebody to actually declare what their position is. If they feel it's a pre-existing condition, you can set that forth in the form of the affidavit, and away you go. Everybody knows where you stand on every issue relating to the damages.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. McCarron? Thank you, Mr. McCarron. Thank you. Mr. Tellinghusen, did you have anything to add after reading the Davenport letter?
Thank you, Chief Justice. I think the only thing that I might add is, first of all, with these time frames, at least I would anticipate that most of the discovery in terms of depositions of expert witnesses that will be offered at trial, whether they be discovery depositions or trial depositions, will have already occurred before this 60-day time frame prior to the commencement of the trial kicks in. So having the ability to file an affidavit stating that the charge was reasonable and that the service was necessary simply joins the issue at that point. And if there is, in fact, a contention in that regard, requiring the other side to file a response if pleading that specifies why they do not believe the charge was reasonable or why the service was necessary, understanding that they now have had the benefit of the discovery that has gone on to date prior to the filing of this initial affidavit, I think would be prudent in terms of expediting the trial and also expediting possibly the resolution of any pretrial motions that need to be taken up before the trial actually begins. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Brown, do you have any response?
No.
Okay. Any response from anybody else, either for or against us, that hasn't had a chance to speak?
I have a question for Mr. Barnett.
I thought Mr. Barnett was exercising his right to remain silent.
Yeah. It's just been waived.
it's one of the dangers of showing up in committees upstairs. You may be called upon.
I just felt it was important that you earn your keep today. As a representative of a group of an association that includes both the offense and the defense here, does the state bar have any position on this measure?
We do not, Justice.
Can you get one in a hurry?
Your Honor, I can. This is the time of the year when bills are offered that the defense lawyers take positions on and the trial lawyers sometimes take positions on, and I hide in a different room. because my members are split. Without action on the part of a solid majority of our members, we stay away from those issues unless it's been acted upon at the annual meeting. The bar commissioners, in the absence of an official position voted on at our annual meeting, will only take positions where we have no choice because somebody dropped a bill in, and we immediately seek out the advice of our standing committees, but ultimately the bar commissioners make those decisions. On an issue like this, I doubt that the bar commissioners would take a position, but if the court wants me to ask, I will ask.
I'm assuming this has not gone through the Civil Procedures Committee or anything.
No.
You're not aware that was ever even introduced or requested of them to take a look at it?
Justice Myrain, my understanding is that no standing committee nor have the bar commissioners examined and studied this issue.
What committee would it go to?
Technically, I think it goes to practice rules.
Has this been tried in any circuit? I know the circuits can adopt their own rules. Has this been offered in the Second Circuit or anywhere else where it's been tried?
Anyway. Looks like we got a comment.
Justice Kornkamp, I'm not aware that it has. As you know, as Chief Justice Gilbertson pointed out at the beginning, this rule was originally proposed by Dean Nacer. I believe that this rule has been implemented in some other states, Texas being one of them, but I am not aware that it's been adopted by local rule in South Dakota.
Okay. You may escape, Mr. Barnett. Any further comments on proposal number 5? If not, the court will then be in recess until our 10 o'clock oral arguments. Thank you.